William Lee Golden, for Pete's sake. What is this beard thing, huh? I'm telling you, I didn't almost recognize you.
My wife vehemently objects, and therefore it's going to be cut very soon.
Yeah, but we have the picture of you. That's the deal. Super Talk 1340 KRMD, the talk of the town. Tom Pace, we'll see you next Saturday, 11 to 1. Y'all be safe and enjoy the weather. CNN News, top of the hour.
Good morning. You are members of the community, and you have expressed your willingness, perhaps not your desire, but your willingness and your ability to serve this community by being seated as jurors. I believe that Mr. Lawrence would agree with Ms. Bush and myself that you are a very special group. The most difficult phase of this case has gone by. That is the jury selection phase. I realize it was cumbersome, it was difficult, it was probably sometimes boring and tedious. We're going to move on. We're going to move on swiftly now, efficiently, and you will be called upon to listen to the evidence. It is now my opportunity to give you an opening statement. An opening statement, as the judge just explained, is designed to explain the nature of the case in general terms, to give you sort of a preview of what Rebecca Bush and I will present to you. I will not stand here and list every witness. I will not stand here and list every piece of evidence. I'm not required necessarily to do that, and it would probably take the rest of the day if I did. So I will talk to you in general terms about what the evidence will present and give you sort of a preview or outline. As you know, Nathaniel Cote is charged by grand jury indictment with the July 19, 1985 first-degree murders of Vivian Cheney, Carlita Culbert, Jerry Culbert, and Billy Joe Harris. In addition to proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Nathaniel Cote committed those quadruple murders of 1985, we will also prove beyond reasonable doubt that he committed the August 31st, 1984 first-degree murder of Deborah Ford, and the 1987 first-degree murders of William T. Code, Joe W. Robinson, and Eric B. Williams. We will present evidence of these other murders for the purpose of showing that between 1984 and 1987, with respect to those murders, Nathaniel Code was involved in a system of killing. He committed very unique, very violent murders of all eight people. We will present evidence in chronological order as best we can, beginning with the 1984 murder of Deborah Ford. After we have presented evidence of the Ford murder, we will then turn to the 1985 quadruple murders of Vivian Cheney and her family. After we have completed that, we will then turn to the 1987 triple murders of William T. Code and the two boys. Deborah Ford was a single mother who lived at 315 East 74th Street here in the Cedar Grove area of Shreveport, Louisiana. The house where she lived was small. It had one bathroom, one small living room area, one kitchen, and maybe one small bedroom. It was a small house on East 74th Street. She had two daughters, Nikki Ford, then about age 9, and Sean Ford, then about age 5. Fortunately for the children, on the night of Deborah's murder, which was the night of August 31st, 1984, Nikki and Sean had actually spent the night and slept at their grandmother's house. However, at about 9 o'clock p.m. or so, Nikki Ford was at Deborah Ford's house on August 30th, 1984. You may use this calendar as a guide. August 30, 1984 would have been on a Thursday night, and we're talking about the period of time of August 30, the nighttime hours, as it rotated into midnight and the morning of August 31st, which was a Friday. Well, at about 9 o'clock p.m. on August 30, 1984, 9-year-old Nikki Ford, little girl, was at the house. She closed their bathroom window. They had a bathroom window, which many times stayed open during the day. And at about 9 o'clock p.m., before she left for her grandmother's house, she closed that window. She placed a little a little thin piece of board over the top half of that window in an effort to secure it. There was no lock on the window. The little tiny piece of board was just sort of stuck in the upper top half of the window in an effort to secure it. The back door of this house always remained locked. It was nailed shut. The only point of entry and exit for the house would have been the front door, through which Deborah Ford and her children came and went all the time. The screen to that bathroom window that I talked about was always nailed shut. At no time during the period when Deborah Ford lived there before August 31st, 1984, that early Friday morning, August 31st, 1984, was that screen pulled away from the window frame. During the early morning hours of August 31, 1984, an assailant approached Deborah Ford's house at 315 East 74th Street. He pried the nailed down screen from the window frame. He pushed open the window and he entered into the residence through that window. As was her usual custom at night, she was on the couch in the living room, either about to go to sleep or was asleep. The assailant first cut an electrical cord off of a box-shaped floor pan, which was located near the kitchen. At some point, either he brought a knife or he armed himself with a knife from the kitchen area. And armed with the kitchen knife and the electrical cord, the assailant carefully went towards the living room where Deborah Ford laid on the couch. It was the worst nightmare come true. The evidence will show that before Deborah could escape from the couch, the assailant began to attack her with the knife. She fought back, and she fought back hard. She did not die easy. The assailant stabbed her multiple times in the chest. He slashed and sawed upon her upper neck and throat at least a half a dozen times, from side to side, ear to ear, cutting her jugular vein, her carotid artery, her esophagus, her larynx, almost into the spine, which is at the back of the neck. As I said, she didn't die easy, and at some point in the ordeal, the assailant placed a gag in her mouth, and he bound her hands behind her back with the electrical cord, which he had previously cut from the box fan near the kitchen. She was butchered, and she was almost beheaded. The evidence will show that she was a very kind woman. She was a single mother of two little girls. The neighbors will testify that she would never have hurt anybody. She didn't have enemies that the neighbors knew about. At around 8 a.m. on August 31, 1984, Deborah Ford's friend, Brenda Greggs, stopped by to visit with her and to use the telephone. When Miss Greggs walked up to the house, she found the front door closed. She heard music inside, and she knocked. She then turned the doorknob and noticed the door was unlocked. She pushed the door open and entered the house, and she found Deborah Ford. Based upon information from neighbors, witnesses, and family members, as well as the evidence at the scene, the police determined that the point of entry was the window of the one bathroom on the one side, on the west side of the house. The screen to that window, which before the early hours of August 31, 1984 had been securely nailed, was pulled away from the window frame and the window was up. Shreveport police officers assigned to the identification division, that is a section or division of the police department that does fingerprint lifting and analysis, carefully examined the window frame as well as the window, and they lifted what were and what appeared to be three left palm prints and one right thumb print from the window frame. There may have been some other similar type fingerprints in there too that they lifted. The prints were retrieved from a section of the window indicating that the assailant had lifted the window and entered through that point, like thus. The police began microscopically examining those prints from the window and the window frame to the prints of certain individuals who police understood Deborah Ford knew or was acquainted with, or against certain people who had, within recent years, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years, had been arrested by police and who police had fingerprints on file for. We all may know that when you're arrested, when one is arrested, one is fingerprinted and booked, and those prints are a part of the Shreveport Police Department files. So the police, in an effort to determine the prints here, they examined, of course, friends of Devercore, people that Devercore knew. They also examined the known prints of people they had arrested within 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. It was not until 3 years later, after the 1985 quadruple homicide of the Vivian Cheney family, and after the 1987 triple homicide of William T. Code and the two boys, it was not until after those killings that Nathaniel Code was examined by police and required to give his fingerprints. Police and fingerprint experts examined Code's prints, this man right here, they examined the ones that he had given them, to the left palm prints and the thumb print left at the point of entry at the Devercore window frame of her bathroom window. The prints were, in fact, one and the same. Police concluded that Nathaniel Code left his palm print on Devercore's window that night on August 31, 1984. Back to August 31, 1984, at 9 o'clock a.m., a crowd gathered outside Deborah Ford's house to watch, to see what was going on. And as the crowd gathered to watch the police retrieve the body of Deborah Ford from the house, this man right here, seated at the end of the table, Nathaniel Code, stood in that crowd, and he watched the results of his handiwork. Cattle Parish Coroner George McCormick, who is an MD as well as a PhD, as well as a forensic pathologist, and his deputy coroner carefully examined the scene. They examined the ligatures, that is, those things that were used to bound Deborah Ford with her hands behind her back. They examined the gag in their mouth. They examined what was gruesome overkill of this woman. They examined the violence committed by the murderer against this helpless woman. While Nathaniel Code stood outside Deborah Ford's house watching her mutilated body being taken from her home, Dr. McCormick told police inside Deborah Ford's home that because of the viciousness, because of the overkill that this killer perpetrated against this woman, that this killer would in fact kill again unless he was caught. He was right. Dr. McCormick was right. About 2 blocks from Deborah Ford's house, in referring to this diagram, Deborah Ford's house, located at 315 East 74th Street, is right here. East 74th Street. The Cheney house is on East 72nd Street, right there. So we're talking about the area between here and here. I will note that Mr. Nathaniel Code at the time lived at 302 East 73rd Street, right in between the house where Deborah Ford lived and the house where Vivian Cheney lived. About 2 blocks from Deborah Ford's house, located at 213 East 72nd Street, also in the Cedar Grove area of Shreveport, Louisiana, lived 6 people. Vivian Cheney, who was about age 34, her daughters, Carlitha Culbert, then age 15, Tamika Shanae Cheney, then age 10, Marla Cheney, then age 7. Vivian Cheney's brother, Jerry Culbert, her common-law husband, Billy Joe Harris. 6 people lived there. Vivian, Carlitha, and Jerry Culbert were all sight impaired. That is, they were not able to see very well, and at least two of those three that were sight impaired were actually legally blind. Tamika Shanae Cheney and Marla Cheney were and or retarded. On the night of July 18, 1985, that was a Thursday night, July 18, 1985, Carlitha Culver, as usual, went to church at the New Star Baptist Church located in the community, about a block away from where she lived. She returned home around 8:30 or 9 o'clock p.m. that particular Thursday night. Vivian and her two younger daughters, Tamika Shanae and Marla, had been out around 8 o'clock p.m., but returned about 8:30 p.m. or 9 o'clock or so. Billy Joe Harris was seen returning to the house by a neighbor around 11:30 p.m. that night. To the outside world, all seemed about normal. And these six people obviously had no idea on July 18, 1985, as to the horror that they were about to experience later that night. And while most members of our community here in Shreveport lay sleeping in the comforts and the security of our beds, the evidence will show that this man right here, Nathaniel Coe, kicked in the back door of the Cheney house and he methodically butchered and killed four human beings. 25-year-old Jerry Culver was shot on the left side of his head. The evidence will show that Nathaniel Coe turned to 29-year-old Billy Joe Harris. He shot him 7 times. 5 times to the head, 2 times to the chest. Billy Joe Harris's hands and his feet were tied to each other, hog-tied with telephone cord, and he bled to death. The evidence will show that Nathaniel Coe turned to 15-year-old Carlitha Culver. He bound her hands behind her back with an electrical cord, and he tied her hands to her left ankle. Her mouth was covered with duct tape. With a sharp knife, probably something like a kitchen knife, he hacked and he sliced multiple times at her neck, severing her carotid artery, jugular vein, and larynx. In an obvious attempt to take her head, to decapitate her, he even cut into her spine. He almost beheaded her. Like Deborah Ford, but only worse, Carlitha Culver's head was almost completely severed from her body by the numerous hacking and slashing with this sharp knife by this man. Vivian Cheney was hogtied, that is, bound hand to feet with a ligature or a binding which came up around her neck with an extra portion left over, which I suggest to you, and which I believe the evidence will show, served as a leash. The evidence indicates that this leash from the ligature would have allowed this murderer to pull, drag Vivian Cheney around the house during the slaughter of her family. Specifically, the evidence shows that he killed Vivian Cheney last after making her watch the near decapitation of her daughter. Vivian Cheney was totally helpless. She was legally blind. She was bound, she was tied, she was gagged with duct tape. She suffered the worst possible degradation of violence that any one person can inflict upon another. Being made to watch as someone slaughters one's child has got to be the worst possible violent degradation that any one person can do to another. The evidence will show that she was beaten in the face. She was taken into the bathroom and strangled, either by the ligature which surrounded her neck or manually by the hands of her attacker. She was strangled. She was drowned. She was left trussed like an animal, tied and partially submerged in the water of the bathtub. Tamika and Marla. The two little girls, 10-year-old Tamika Shanae Cheney and 7-year-old Marla Cheney, remained in their rooms, probably in their beds. Those two children are both retarded. The two little girls have been repeatedly questioned by family members as to what happened there that night. They have been repeatedly questioned by psychologists, psychiatrists, police, social workers. They have been hypnotized. One of them has been injected with sodium pentothal, which is a drug sometimes used to enhance recollection and to enhance truthful testimony. In addition, an expert from Los Angeles, California, hired by the defense, has examined videotape interviews and police reports, transcripts, and evidence concerning their statements about what did or didn't happen that night. All of these experts agree that due to the mental retardation of these two little girls, they do not possess a sufficient level of intelligence to be able to comprehend questions about what happened that night or to explain any recollection or of any sort as to the events of that early morning. And Rebecca Bush and I agree upon is that those two little girls are incompetent to testify. They are incompetent. They don't possess the competency or the capacity to come into court and testify. Mr. Lawrence agrees with that. Ms. Bush agrees with that. I agree with that. They're not able to testify in a court of law or anywhere else about what happened that night. However, I will show, and Rebecca Bush and I will show together, that the statements given by these children to family members, to psychologists, psychiatrists, some of which were given under the influence of sodium pentothal, some of which were given under hypnosis. We will provide all of that to you because we want you to know what they said. I suggest to you, and the expert witnesses will say that they are not believable. We wish they were, but they are not competent to testify. But nevertheless, we will provide you with all that information so that you can hear it and assess whatever weight you do see appropriate. I will certainly not call them into this courtroom to testify further, traumatize them, nor will Mr. Lawrence do that. Back to July 19, 1985, there will be testimony that Nathaniel Cote was seen in the area of the Cheney house during the early morning hours at approximately 2:30 a.m. or so. And again, he was seen outside very close to the Cheney house on East 72nd Street at about 5 o'clock a.m. or so, where he stood at the corner of East 72nd and Henderson, grinning and looking in the direction of the Cheney house. I suggest to you, in anticipation of the discovery of what he had done, at 6:30 a.m. on July 19, 1985, a Friday, Vivian Cheney's sister, Shirley Colbert, made a surprise visit to 213 East 72nd Street. She had ridden the bus from California, where she lived at the time, to Shreveport. She ultimately intended to continue her travels to Alexandria, where the rest of her family lived. She thought she could stop off in Shreveport on her way to Alexandria and see her sister Vivian, her brother Jerry Colbert, and her little nieces Carlitha, Tamika, and Marla. From the bus station here in Shreveport, she took a taxi cab to Vivian's house. Her plan was to surprise her sister and the other members of the family, the little girls. She hoped to have a warm, nice visit with them. The taxi driver at about 6:30 a.m. on Friday, July 19, drove up to the house and remained there momentarily while Shirley Colbert knocked on the front door. She wasn't positive where the house was. She had the address. She had never been there before, and she asked the taxi cab driver to remain momentarily so that she would make absolutely sure that was the right house. She could hear music on inside, but when she knocked at the front door, no one answered. She walked around to the back door, which was unlocked, but it was shut. She knocked on it. It was shut. She turned the doorknob, much as Brenda Greggs had done in 84, and entered the house. She first saw Jerry Colbert lying in a pool of blood. He had been shot once in the left side of the head. Due to the position that he was in and the fact that she did not see any blood upon first glance, she initially thought he was merely asleep. She started talking to him, and he didn't say anything. She took a closer look, saw blood around his nose. She still didn't know at that point that he was dead. She went to the kitchen and into Tamika and Marla's room.
and they were laying in bed. They were asleep. They were alive, but they were asleep. She tried to get them up, but they would not awake. She then looked into the next room, and she saw Billy Joe Harris on his bed. He had on his regular clothes, his hat. She observed that he was, however, tied up. She then went into the living room and saw her little niece, Carlita, her little 15-year-old niece, tied up, bound with duct tape, and lying in a massive pool of blood. She then turned and entered the bathroom, and she saw her sister Vivian draped over the bathtub, tied hand to foot. She ran to the little girls and got them out of the house. Police were called, patrol officers, identification officers. Again, the identification officers are the ones that do the fingerprint work, the photography work, the video work at a crime scene, as well as Cattle Parish coroner, Dr. George McCormick. The crime scene was closely examined. They particularly closely scrutinized, closely examined the bathtub where Vivian Cheney had been strangled and drowned. The experts in the field of fingerprinting did find prints in that bathtub. They did lift and preserve the prints as well as the bathtub itself, which we will also introduce in this case as evidence. Two of the prints were next to the left side of Vivian's body, and a palm print was across the opposite side of the tub from Vivian's body. Just like in the Deborah Ford case a year prior to this 1985 murder, experts with the Shreveport Police Department had found prints of the assailant, and they worked day and night comparing and contrasting known prints from any of the hundreds and literally thousands of people who had been arrested between 1980 and 1985. They also compared and contrasted those prints from the bathtub against any prints that were the children's or any other witnesses that they could possibly determine, any acquaintances, anybody. But you see, between 1980 and 1985, Nathaniel Code had not been arrested. His prints were not on file. And of course, his fingerprints would not have come up. It was not until 2 years later, in 1987, and it was not until there were three more vicious, violent killings, until on the evening of August 5th, 1987, that Nathaniel Code was examined by police. It was not until the police compared his known palm prints and fingerprints to those prints found on the Cheney tub that they caught the killer. On August 5, 1987, Shreveport Police Officer Sergeant Mark Rogers, who is an expert in the field of fingerprint identification and analysis, matched Nathaniel Code's prints to those prints, those several prints in the bathtub. Specifically, the left-handed palm print on the bathtub across from the beaten, tied corpse of Vivian Cheney was in fact left there by Nathaniel Code during his vicious rampage throughout that house that night. That palm print, without any doubt whatsoever, tells us that he is the murderer of that family. And although those palm prints and fingerprints may not verbally speak, they do speak very loudly about that man seated right here before us. Those palm prints belong to the only one individual on this planet, Nathaniel Code, who left his mark that night. As Caddo Parish coroner Dr. George McCormick examined the findings of these victims, again, they were bound with electrical cords, much like Deborah Ford. They examined the vicious overkill and the vicious mutilation of these people. And as he did so, Dr. McCormick thought of the Deborah Ford killing. The similarities were glaring, and the similarities spoke loudly, and he will tell you about that. He told the police at the Cheney House that day in 1985, July 1985, just as he did at the Ford House on August 31, '84, that this killer was extremely vicious, he was extremely ruthless, and he would strike again. He would kill again unless he was caught. As police and coroner staff scrutinized that evidence that day, July 19, 1985, a crowd of people gathered outside the Cheney House. Among the people in the crowd was, again, Nathaniel Code, just like he had done in 1984 outside the Ford House. He had arrived on July 19, 1985 to see the results and the aftermath of his butchering. He was there to watch, and he was there to anticipate the discovery of what he had done. Between 1985 and 1987, police organized a task force. They worked long hours. They worked diligently. They knew that the man who killed Deborah Ford and four members of the Vivian Cheney family would kill again. They were right. In 1987, and up until 1987, William T. Code, the adoptive grandfather of Nathaniel Code, lived at 641 West 66th Street. I would point to it on this diagram. 641 West 66th Street. It is obviously north of 70th Street, but I think considered within the neighborhood of Cedar Grove here in Shreveport, County Parish, Louisiana. Many years ago, William T. Code had married Nathaniel Code's grandmother, and while Nathaniel Code is not related by blood, he's not related by blood to William T. Code. He is related by marriage, and he did serve as the adoptive grandfather of Nathaniel Code. And did live with him for a certain period of time until about 1975, or 1976 rather, when Nathaniel Code did not live in Shreveport. Nathaniel Code did not live in Shreveport between 1976 and January 23rd, 1984. Beginning in late January 1984, he moved to Shreveport and lived in Shreveport from that time to the present. In 1987, William T. Code was 73 years old. Joe W. Robinson was 12 years old, and Eric B. Williams was 8 years old. Josephine Code had died in the some good while back, some years ago, and Mr. William T. Code had a lady friend by the name of Enamortine Williams. Enamortine Williams was the grandmother of Joe W. Robinson and Eric B. Williams. The parents of Joe W. Robinson and Eric B. Williams had died in completely unrelated accidents in previous years, and Enamortine Williams, their grandmother, served as their parent. Enamortine Williams was the lady friend of 73-year-old William T. Code, and one of William T. Code's passions in life was those two little boys, the 8-year-old and the 12-year-old. He loved them. They spent a lot of time together. Basically, William T. Code served as their daddy. William T. Code was retired from the military. He had served his country. He worked at the age of 73. He worked at Wellman Funeral Home. And as I indicated, his passion in life included loving those two little boys. His passion in life included mowing his yard, keeping his yard clean, and he had earned at age 73 the right to be respected. William T. Code was a very conscientious man about security. His friends and family will testify that he was very careful about who he would let in his house. He was an older gentleman. He didn't let just anybody come in his house and hang around. He didn't let people just hang around in his yard. He was a little bit conscious about security. In fact, he had burglar bars on his windows. In fact, he had his front door had a double door, a kind of a guard door and a regular door. It was not his practice to let anyone in his house unless he absolutely knew them and liked them. Being the type of man that he was, he took, as I indicated, a tremendous amount of pride in mowing his yard and keeping his yard clean. His habits were fairly well defined in terms of about when he would go to bed, about when he would get up, the things that he liked, the things that he didn't like. As I indicated, he was an older gentleman, and his habits were very well defined by age 73. It was customary to see him drinking coffee, for instance, at 6:30 a.m. It was customary to see his lights out at 10:30 p.m. It was customary to see him going to work at Wellman Funeral Home at 7:30 or 8 a.m. On August 4, 1987, a Tuesday, at about 6 p.m., Mr. William Tico was at his home at 641 West 66th Street with the two boys. And Nemerton Williams had, as he had done many times before, let the two little boys spend the night over there. I'm not sure if initially it was the plan for them to spend the night there, but they had spent the night there many times before, and they were over there that day, that Tuesday afternoon, helping Mr. William T. Mow his yard and keep it and get his yard cleaned up. Well, they decided to go ahead and spend the night there, and Ms. Williams allowed them to spend the night there, as she had done many times before. Neighbors saw them between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. all out there mowing the yard, getting the yard all cleaned up. Everything between 6 o'clock and about 8 o'clock p.m. on August 4, 1987 seemed okay. Everything during that little period of time on Tuesday between 6 and 8 p.m. seemed normal. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. At around 8 o'clock or 8:30 p.m. or so, the mowing and yard work was completed. The boys and Mr. William Tico went inside. Donald Ray Johnson, a neighbor who lives about three houses down the street, actually at 629 West 66th Street, happened to see Mr. Nathaniel Code leaving the home of William T. Code. Donald Ray Johnson was very close to William T. Code. Donald Ray Johnson is a relatively young man in his 30s, and he had visited at the home of William T. Code. They were very close friends. Donald Ray loved him, looked to him as a father figure. Donald Ray Johnson knew that, he basically knew the likes and the dislikes of Mr. William T. Code, which, as I indicated, were very well defined. Donald Ray Johnson knew that William T. Code didn't care for Nathaniel Code, didn't like him. Donald Ray Johnson was outside about 8:30 or so in that range, and he looked up. He just happened to look up, and he saw a man leaving the home of William T. Code. He thought he couldn't identify the man immediately because it was three houses down, but he thought it was unusual because he understood the habits of Mr. William T. Code. The habit of Mr. William T. Code was that when someone would come visit, he would greet them at the door and let them in if he wanted to let them in. Likewise, when that visitor, whoever he was about to leave, William T. Code would walk him out, walk with him out the door. But at this point, at 8:30 or so p.m. that night, Donald Ray Johnson looked up and he saw a man leaving, and he was unescorted. He was by himself. He thought it was a little bit unusual, although it didn't strike him as just extraordinarily any big deal. But he noted it as being unusual. The man got into the vehicle and drove down the street towards Donald Ray Johnson's house. And as the man, and it was a woman who was also in the car, as they got closer to Donald Ray Johnson's house, he realized who it was. He knows Nathaniel R. Code, Jr. He saw him, and it was the same man who left the house at 8:30 p.m. Code slowed the car. Donald Ray looked at him, and the two of them spoke briefly. The next morning, on August 5, 1987, neighbors who were very close to William P. Code observed that there was no movement around his house. He was not on his front porch as usual, drinking his coffee at 6:30 or 7 a.m. The cars that were parked in the driveway remained there all day. The house was suspiciously quiet, and neighbors who were very fond of this old gentleman became increasingly concerned. The employer of Mr. William P. Code at Wellman Funeral Home became very concerned because it was not like William P. Code not to come to work. Mrs. Namertine Williams had expected the little boys to be back at her house by 7 a.m. to have breakfast. They did not appear. Throughout the day, on August 5, 1987, family, friends, neighbors became increasingly concerned. This had never happened before. The evidence will show that between 8:15, 8:30 or so on August 4, 1987, and 6:30 a.m. on August 5, 1987, Nathaniel Code, this man before you today, was led into the house probably by one of the little boys. When he got into the house, he pounded one of the boys, Joe W. Robinson Jr., in the face. He took a vacuum cleaner, he took a round humidifier, or floor fan rather, which resembles a humidifier, and a telephone. And with the vacuum cleaner, with the floor fan, which resembles a humidifier, and with the telephone, he cut those cords. And in the same method in which he tied up Deborah Ford, Vivian Cheney, Carlitha Covert, and Billy Joe Harris, he used those electrical cords from those appliances to tie Joe W. Robinson's and Eric B. Williams' hands and feet together. Joe W. Robinson, 12-year-old Joe Robinson, had a dish towel or a rag stuffed in his mouth, just as Deborah Ford was gagged, and just as Vivian Cheney and Carly Covert were gagged. Joe W. Robinson's hands were bound behind his back, and he also was hogtied, hands to feet. He was strangled with the tight binding or tight ligature around his neck. He was strangled to death. 8-year-old Eric Williams was also bound hands to feet with rope or an electrical cord with a little extra piece of the cord left here, which may have served as a gag or may have served as a leash. He was also strangled with electrical cord from one of the three appliances which I mentioned. The little eight-year-old boy was strangled to death, just as was the little 12-year-old boy, Joe Robinson. 73-year-old William T. Code was also gagged. His hands and his ankles were bound behind his back and tied to each other. He had been struck numerous times in the head. He had been stabbed 5 times in the chest. He had been stabbed 7 times in the back, and he bled to death. William P. Code was slashed and cut, mutilated in the bedroom of his own home. There was blood on the bed, there was blood on the clothing, there was blood spatter on the walls or on the baseboard of the wall. Identification police officers observed and examined the blood spatter. They took pictures of it, and they retrieved a sample reference of the blood spatter. William T. Code had gone to the bank the previous day on Tuesday, August 4, 1987. He had cashed his military retirement check. As I indicated, he had served his country. He, at age 73, was receiving military retirement. He had earned it. He also was employed at Wellman Funeral Home, as I indicated, and he had taken his checks up to the bank and deposited at least one in cash sum. He had approximately $500 to $700 on August 4, 1987. That money was not found in his house on August 5, 1987. It had been taken during the commission of the murders. The evidence will show that on August 4, 1987, Nathaniel Code was in need of money. He was desperately in need of money. He wanted money. He had gone around the neighborhood in Cedar Grove asking for money. Various witnesses will come into this courtroom and they will testify that on August 4, 1987, Nathaniel Code asked them for money. $20 here, $20 there. In fact, on August 4, 1987, Nathaniel Code even went to the police department and told the police department officers, undercover officers, that he would do narcotics work, undercover narcotics work, for money. After the murder on August 5, 1987, Nathaniel Code was observed by at least one person to have more money than she had ever seen him with before. Hundreds of dollars of valuables and money Nathaniel Code had in his possession on August 5, 1987, in the afternoon hours. That person will testify in this court as to what she saw and what they did. When the bodies of William T. Code, Joe Robinson, and Eric Williams were discovered about 6:30 p.m. that day on August 5, it was raining very hard. It was sort of a downpour that day as we got closer to the later afternoon hours. But just as he had done, just as Nathaniel Code had done outside the home of Deborah Ford in 1984, just as he had done outside the home of Vivian Cheney in 1985, there he was in the crowd on that rainy day. For the third time in 3 years, he stood in that crowd to observe the aftermath and the results of his handiwork. However, this time was different. His behavior excited the police. They began to, based on what they observed, they began to look at him. And they said, "Come here, sir." Based upon certain things the police learned about this man, Mr. Code, they obtained his fingerprints and his palm prints. Because of the similarities of the three crimes within 3 years, Code's known prints, the prints that he gave them, were examined against the prints lifted from Deborah Ford's window frame and the prints lifted from Vivian Cheney's bathtub. The prints were, in fact, one and the same. As I said earlier, he's the only man on this planet, the only person on this planet who left those prints on the window frame, the point of entry of Deborah Ford's house, and the bathtub of Vivian Cheney. And they will forever bind him to those murders and those crime scenes. Following Mr. Code's arrest, police searched his home. And they found interesting items. You will learn about those items. He had a fascination with electrical cords. Liked to cut them, liked to tie them. Police found cut electrical cords at his home. Found duct tape at his home. Police also seized at his home a pair of black tennis shoes belonging to Mr. Code. Those shoes were taken to the North Louisiana Crime Lab. An expert in the field of forensic serology, which includes the identification and analysis of body liquids, body fluids, that sort of thing. Carefully examined the shoes for blood. There was, in fact, human blood on Nathaniel Coates' shoes. Not very much. There was human blood, however, on his shoes. That same forensic serologist had also received the baseboard. You recall the baseboard that I told you about from the bedroom of William T. Coates' home. It had blood spatter on it. This forensic serologist found and had examined the baseboard. He had examined the shoes. The blood was of a size and characteristic to be consistent with medium velocity blood spatter. Low velocity blood spatter might be caused by one's nose bleeding. Medium velocity blood spatter is entirely different. It is produced by force, like a fist, like a tool, like an instrument of some sort, being applied to blood to such an extent that the contact creates a particular splattering effect. Well, there was blood spatter on those black tennis shoes found in Mr. Coates' home. There was blood spatter found on that baseboard, and the blood spatter was consistent. To summarize, Nathaniel Coates stands charged in this proceeding with the first-degree murders of Vivian Cheney, Paulitha Culbert, Billy Joe Harris, and Jerry Culbert. We will introduce evidence of the 1984 Deborah Ford murder, and we will introduce evidence of the 1987 murders of William T. Coates and the two boys. All of these murders are, in fact, signature murders committed by the same killer. And there he sits, right there. In this opening statement, I have tried to present to you a general overview of what the evidence will show. Rebecca Bush and I will present a tremendous volume of evidence. We will present expert testimony. We will present civilian testimony, police testimony about all of these events. Suffice it to say that we will prove the case by the introduction of relevant, competent, physical, and testimonial evidence. We will prove beyond a reasonable doubt that on July 19, 1985, Nathaniel R. Coates Jr. committed four brutal, senseless, vicious, horrifying first-degree murders. And as the deputy clerk stated to you, please stand together and hear this evidence. Give this man a fair trial and hold him accountable for what he has done. Thank you.